Hello and welcome to the TNW podcast, the show in which we discuss the latest developments in the European technology ecosystem and follow occasional interviews with some of the most interesting people in the industry. My name is Andriy Degeler. I am the head of media at TNW.
And I'm Linnea Algen, senior editor at TNW.
Lydia, how are you doing today?
I'm okay, thank you. I somehow have failed to have my second coffee of the morning, so I'll do my best.
It's already lunchtime for everybody listening in, so and I really don't know how you are still awake.
No, usually there's a second bout of caffeine by now, so but we'll see how we go.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, before we move on, I just wanted to very quickly report that I spent two great days in Brussels this week. I went to the EIC summit, which was part of the Research and Innovation Week organized by the European Commission. So basically a lot of Commission people, a lot of conversations about policy and how the Commission is supporting startups and scale-ups and deep tech in general in Europe. But a great time, a really good time. I don't often come to Brussels, so this was a very good opportunity to see all the people. I learned a lot of gossip.
Oh, I haven't heard that yet. I'm looking forward to the post-recording conversation. But I think this is such an interesting example of how, even though most of us feel like the decisions made in Brussels and European policy can be quite far away from our everyday lives, when it comes to initiatives like this, for startups and scale-ups in particular, this has a really real impact on their potential to grow and their ability to do business. And so I really encourage everyone to see what the EU is doing on that level.
Yeah, it's a really, really big thing. And we usually talk about one part of it, which is the EIC Accelerator Program. So the fund from where they invest in startups, so doing equity deals, but also provide grant funding. But there is actually more within the agency, EISMEA, and they do a lot of things from the very beginning, from seed stage, and then all the way until the companies get to a pretty large scale. And then there is also the EIT, all the versions of the EIT and everything else. So there is literally something for everyone. And I do think that it's probably underrepresented at this point. And this is something that I think has been changing in general over the past couple of years, but it's still not enough.
Are they not doing a good enough job, do you think, of communicating that this exists?
That's a good question. I think it's been for a very long time. It had been something that either, if you know, you know, and then those who were in the know were able to use it and get great outcomes. But at the same time, I do feel that some startups are still sort of afraid of all the paperwork and all the extra things and extra reporting that you need to do if you want to get one of those grants. But as far as I understand, this is also changing. So they are actually streamlining some of the reporting procedures from what I've heard. So we are getting there. And one way or the other, even if you're getting VC funding, you will have to do more reporting than you did before. So it's not that different anymore. Right. Okay. So let's move to today's episode. We are going to discuss some supercomputers in the Nordics. We will talk about Stability AI and Stable Diffusion creators. We will also discuss scientific journals and what weird things you can find in there sometimes. And also we will talk about the way our brain constructs reality. Okay, that is a lot of stuff. And also there will be an interview, a really interesting one with Tanguy Goretti and Adrian Roos, the co-founders of the Belgian-born e-bike startup Cowboy. We did actually go and see and try the e-bike, so we're going to discuss this as well before we dive into that conversation. But before that, a story that we did cover this week. Helenia, what did you find the most interesting for yourself?
Well, so this is really for myself because I get to talk about one of my favorite topics at the moment, which is supercomputers. These are types of computers that have much higher levels of performance compared to general purpose computers. I think it's worth noting that they are not quantum computers. I feel that sometimes people can get the terms a little bit confused. Although obviously our listeners are quite well versed in this kind of space, but still.
So supercomputer is basically just a very, very big and very powerful version of a conventional computer.
Yes, exactly.
There we go. And I thought your topic, your favorite topic, was AI before. So now it's HPC. Why is supercomputers your favorite?
Well, this is actually a combination, but there's a lot happening in this space right now, and it's as a result of the AI race, but also geopolitics. And I have a background in international relations, or I have a degree in international relations. So this really sort of sits at the intersection of my fields and interests. But anyway, supercomputers, they used to be sort of the purview of a select group of researchers that would use them to run sophisticated simulations for science that would take years on lower performance systems. But now, because of how useful they are in training AI, specifically large foundational models like GPT-4 or Gemini, it seems like everybody wants one. And they are owned by both governments and also and private companies. And the latest country to ring the supercomputer bell is Denmark, who is setting up a system called Gefion. And it says that it will be a top 25 supercomputer globally in terms of performance.
Is it really cool? Like, how many supercomputers are there? So if it's in top 25, does mean it's really, really good?
Oh, well, there's a list called the top 500.
Okay.
In terms of high performance computing systems. Not everybody discloses how fast their supercomputer is. So the list does not include all supercomputers that exist and potentially not some of the most powerful as well.
Right. So top 25 is like really cool.
But top 25 is really cool. Yeah. So as happens quite often with these high performance computing or HPC, like you said, systems, Gefion is named after deity. Specifically this time after the Norse goddess of plowing and abundance. She's also the goddess of unmarried women.
Okay.
But I'm not sure how much that was their target reference when they chose the name. Anyway, it will belong to the Danish Center for AI Innovation. And this will be set up by the Danish pharmaceutical giant Novo Nordisk's investment branch. It's pitching in 80 million euros to the project. And it's in collaboration with, drumroll, NVIDIA.
Okay, that's interesting. And how does NVIDIA come into it?
So Gefion, first of all, will feature over 1,500 of NVIDIA's H100 Tensor Core GPUs. This is not, we should note, the new GPU that NVIDIA launched in the week that passed, which is called Blackwell. It's the version prior. And this sort of attests to the sheer velocity of development happening in the hardware space for AI-specific purposes right now, and how difficult it will be to keep up with what is the state of the art. But before you imagine that it's a lot of GPUs, by the way, you should know that the EU's first exascale supercomputer, Jupiter, will have close to 24,000 NVIDIA GH200 superchips. And this is a combination
like 16 times more.
Of GPUs and CPUs. Yes, indeed.
Okay.
So you can see how NVIDIA is doing pretty well at the moment.
So we're back to the computers of the size of a room.
Yeah.
But this time it's supercomputers.
Yeah. Oh, they're the size of many rooms. They sit in very, very large data centers with servers just humming away. So a supercomputer takes up a lot of space. And it also takes a lot of energy, which is why we're seeing a push towards more and more data centers that run on renewables. Right. For example, you have one in an old mining town in the center of Sweden. And this one as well, Gefion, will run at a data center that is also powered 100% by renewable energy.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense. That's at least something.
Yeah, and I think we're going to see more and more of this with requirements from regulators into energy efficiency of data centers. Because this is one of the main concerns also with more and more AI models running that and being trained is the CO2 aspect. Anyway, but I digress. So the collaboration between NVIDIA and Denmark or Novo Nordisk also includes other aspects. And it's related to what Jensen Huang just called the company's sort of AI foundry range of services. And I attended a pre-press briefing ahead of the NVIDIA Developer Conference. And Kimberly Powell, who's the VP of Healthcare at NVIDIA, said, in our collaboration agreement, we'll be taking all of this generative AI that then Gefion is building and bring it over to their sovereign AI infrastructure so that they, meaning Denmark and Novo Nordisk, essentially can really push into advancing medicine, quantum computing, and social sciences.
Okay, so supercomputers are not quantum computers. We already established that, but I seem to recall that there was actually a mention of quantum in this story. So how does it all come together?
Yes, so even though Gefion will not feature the new NVIDIA GPU, it will feature another thing from NVIDIA's development conference, and that's the new CUDA-Q software. So it's CUDA quantum software. So this will allow for what I think will be one of the main applications of quantum computer systems for the immediate future. And this is where smaller scale quantum qubit systems are utilized to carry out highly specific simulations in collaboration with classical computers. This is usually referred to as quantum classical hybrid systems. And Gefion will start running pilot programs this year and then reach full operational capacity, which means it will have a 6 exaflop AI training capacity in 2025.
Okay, 6 exaflop AI training capacity. And now, can you now say the same thing, but in plain English? So what does it mean? How does it compare to anything?
So AI performance, when it comes to capacity of AI performance or AI training capacity, means that it has this capacity specifically in tasks related to AI.
Mm-hmm.
NVIDIA's own EOS supercomputer, also named after Goddess of the Dawn, which runs at an undisclosed location, they are not sharing where the servers are actually located, that has 18.4 exaflops of AI performance.
Okay, so.
But in order to be a true exascale supercomputer, then the system needs to exceed the threshold of 1 billion billion calculations or 1 exaflop per second for a wide range of tasks, meaning not limited to AI.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
There's currently only one system in the world that can do this, and it's the Frontier. It's housed at the Oak Ridge Leadership Computing Facility in Tennessee in the U.S. Although, as we have mentioned before in the podcast, China has stopped disclosing its supercomputer capacities, so we don't really know what they are capable of.
But then you also mentioned that there is an exascale computer in Europe. Is it also not an exascale computer?
No, so this will be a true exascale system.
Okay.
So this is being built by the joint supercomputer undertaking called EuroHPC.
Right.
It's run by the EU, but also in collaboration with the member states, but also non-member states. But it is supporting not one, but 2 exascale computers in the EU. And the project is installing the system called Jupiter at the Jülich Supercomputing Center in Germany this year. And then there's a second system called the Jules Verne that will come online in France in 2025. The UK is also building an exascale supercomputer in Edinburgh, as well as an AI supercomputer system in Bristol. So, like I said, there's a lot happening. I would say it's the most momentum that high-performance computing has had in Europe ever in such a short amount of time. So it's really exciting to follow.
Yeah, and back to the Danish one. So does the fact that Novo Nordisk is participating this closely in the project, does it mean that they will exclusively be able to use this supercomputer for their purposes, drug discovery or whatever it may be?
That is unclear as to right now. There's also the Danish investment council is also adding, I think, about 10 million euros to the project. It's unclear specifically how much Novo Nordisk will use it for its own purposes, but this is the Novo Nordisk Foundation,
right,
which is more of an investment branch, albeit only investing in projects that will somehow serve the larger group of Novo Nordisk. So it remains to be seen, because this is also something very interesting with supercomputers, especially the ones that belong to research centers and universities, like the one in Tennessee, for example. How much do you want to give of the uptime, meaning the time on the servers, to research, and how much do you want to give to business-related purposes,
right,
specifically for training LLMs, etc.? So this is how business / academia and science have access to these systems will also be something that I think will differ from region to region, but also from system to system.
Right. At some point, it probably will be a good idea to maybe run a story on that, to have some, to do some research and how it actually works for different different locations.
Yeah, absolutely.
Great. Okay, next up is a story that we did not cover this week, that which still deserves our attention. And for this story, I decided to pick the news of three more senior researchers resigning from the UK-based company that's called Stability AI.
Ouch.
Yeah, that's not great. Absolutely not. So several outlets reported that one of the creators of the very stable diffusion model, Robin Rombach, had resigned from the company, and together with him left two of his team members and, as far as I understand, former PhD students of his, Andreas Blattmann and Dominic Lorenz. These were three out of five authors who actually developed the core stable diffusion model initially, which is something that Stability AI supported and invested into a lot, but also built quite some of its products on top of.
There was another high-profile resignation quite recently from
Stability, there were multiple. Right? There were multiple indeed. Definitely not the first one. We previously covered on the website the resignation of Ed Newton-Rex, who left the company in protest of how it approaches training its models on copyrighted materials. And Ed was the VP of audio. But also the company seems to have quietly replaced its CTO earlier this year in January. So, and before that, there were also a number of changes and departures tracked by different media outlets. So something is definitely going on. So according to multiple reports, most of which I think by Forbes and Bloomberg so far, Stability has also been struggling financially. Mm-hmm. So it raised $100 million US dollars in 2022 at a unicorn valuation, basically riding the this very first wave of generative AI hype. But reportedly, it had not been able to attract a follow-on round, which it planned at $400 million US dollars in 2023. So last October, Intel, of all companies, invested $50 million US dollars in a convertible note deal into Stability AI. And additionally, the company also sold off the French startup ClipDrop, which it acquired about a year ago. But still, it's anyone's guess how long the company's runway at this point is.
So do you think that there's any potential of it being acquired at this point or being picked up by one of the bigger players in the space?
So that's the big question, because the company itself said recently that it had no intention to sell. It didn't want to be acquired by a bigger player. But then again, with the recent news of Microsoft effectively purchasing Inflection, founded by Mustafa Suleiman, would it be that crazy, really, to think that Stability could end up in a similar position? I'm sure there are suitors among the big tech firms already. I'm sure that there are conversations going on, but it's not entirely clear what's going to happen. Also, Stability is making an effort to get to profitability, or at least to start losing less money. They have created a paid tier to use their model and the services for commercial purposes, which didn't exist before. So basically, there is definitely a move within the company to get some money flowing in. And again, don't get me wrong. I think Stability is a great company that actually did a lot to build and promote open source generative AI capabilities with the effort of Stable Diffusion and everything else that it did. But it does seem to be going through quite some internal transformation, to put it this way. And I'm very actually curious to see how it pans out after all.
Likewise.
And by the way, Stability CEO Imad Mostak, he's actually coming to our conference in June in Amsterdam. So I actually hope that we or you or I, Linnea, will be able to ask all these questions directly and perhaps even on stage. So for all the listeners, stay tuned, or better still, get a ticket, join us in the summer, say hi to us, and listen to Stability AI's CEO from one of our stages.
Andrew was giggling there on the mention of on stage, because he knows how much I love speaking in front of people.
You're great on stage, though.
Thank you.
You should be doing this more often. Okay, so moving on to one of our favorite segments of the week. This week we learned. Linnea, what did you learn?
So I guess it's a little bit cheating because it's something that I learned from a story that I covered. So I'm referring to two stories that I covered this week. But I did find it really fascinating as I'm really into the human brain and how specifically how it constructs reality. And if I could go back and choose my field of study all over again, I'd probably go for neuroscience. So what I learned is that our brains are the most energy demanding organ in our body. It uses half of all the sugar energy that we have. Yes. And this is why carbs make you think better. So if you see me with a croissant in the afternoon, it's only because I'm trying to come up with smart things to write for our audience. But seriously, because the brain is so energy intensive, it is also trying its best to save energy. And this is what I learned. It's called the free energy principle. And in order to do this, to save energy, the brain works not by always seeing what is actually there, but by filling in things with predictions of what you will see or experience, so that it doesn't have to spend energy on sort of calculating everything again and again. You can compare it to, say, I see that there is a wall to my right. I don't have to look all the time. I know that the wall is there. If I think about the space, I will know that the wall is there. I don't have to look at all the pixels that are there in the wall, etc. Like, I know that it's in its place. But more than that, the brain also actively goes looking for new data to add to its world model that it has created so that it can make better predictions in the future. Say, we just moved to a new office here in the building, and there's a random step, let's say, that you have to step down in order to get into the office, but it's the same color as the floor and it's quite, you can't really notice it. But so the first time that I'm walking there, maybe my brain doesn't see it because my brain is not predicting that there will be a step
there. Your brain thinks that it's just a level floor.
My brain thinks that it's a level floor. But then I suddenly step over the step. I'm like, oh, wait, that was not a good prediction. And so my brain then updates its model. And now it knows that there's a step there. Now it doesn't have to keep updating that, right? So it's in the system. So kudos to our brains, because otherwise we'd be pretty stuck. But this takes energy. And this is actually why it will feel longer to travel a road that you have never taken before. And then it will feel shorter when you go that same way again.
Okay, that's a good explanation. That's a really good way of looking at it.
So if you haven't thought about it before, notice that the next time you're in a car, if you're going somewhere new, then it will feel much longer than the second or third time.
Go
the same way, right? So that's kind of what happens, because the brain is just predicting and filling in the space for itself rather than actually taking in all the new information that was coming at it the first time. But this active looking is called active inference.
Mm-hmm. Nice. So I've learned something else this week. That's very nice. Now I know about the way the brain constructs reality, indeed. And this comes from your piece about an actual model that uses the same principle, right?
Yes, exactly. So yes, it is about AI. And there's a company called Stanhope AI, and it was founded by three very top tier neuroscience researchers. In computational neuroscience and in psychiatric neuroscience and two top tier neuroscience researchers and then their CTO. They're training in AI, but they're actually specifically not training an AI. They are building an AI that can function in the same way as the human brain, meaning that it's learning from real-time data and then updating its worldview of its model of the world, rather. So you don't have to feed it with training data. It takes care of that itself. And then it can make its own decisions based on what it's learning. So you have to make sure that the prior belief system is the right one. And then the AI will take care of the rest itself. You sort of send it out into the world, and then it gathers information through a visual system, say through cameras or through LiDAR, and then it assimilates that data and comes up with new approaches.
That's really interesting. I would love to see what comes out of it and whether this model is, it's supposed to be less, it's supposed to be less prone to hallucinations.
Yes, absolutely. Right? Yes. So it is currently being trialed in drones. Mm-hmm. And that's the sort of first commercial use case for it as well.
Let's just hope it doesn't go horribly wrong at some point. But that's what the prior beliefs are for, I suppose.
That's what the prior beliefs are for. Also, there's a kill switch.
That's always good to know. Okay, more AI from my side for this week's learning. I'm sorry, this looks like we've only been talking about that the entire time. But we're gonna talk about a great electric bike in just a minute. But the fact that I learned was really interesting. I really found it quite fascinating, although a bit unsettling. So I learned this week that there seem to be a whole lot of published scientific papers that are indexed by Google Scholar. And these papers appear to contain information generated by ChatGPT or other GenAI models.
I also heard this...
It's not. It's not exactly. If you think about it, it's not something that should surprise you all that much. But still, it's not great. So where I learned it from was that several journalists and researchers, they recently posted about many papers that contain what seems to be AI-generated text. And namely, they looked for three very standard phrases from when you talk to ChatGPT. One is, as of my last knowledge update. The other is, I don't have access to real-time data. And the third one, funny, is, certainly here is. So if you have ever talked to ChatGPT, you will definitely recognize all three phrases. And so many of the journals where these articles that contain these phrases were published, they seem to be what's known as paper mills. And those are publications that would basically run pretty much anything but charge a lot of money for the privilege. And this is not a new problem. I mean, it's been in academia for a while and everybody knows that it exists, but it's pretty hard to deal with it.
You always have to check which publication. Yeah. You cannot just see that, oh, there has been a paper published. You also have to check.
Yeah, exactly.
Here. The publication.
But some publications where the AI-generated copy made its way to, they do appear to be like legitimate ones. And they are supposedly peer-reviewed ones as well. And that's a dangerous thing because this kind of precedent, in my view, could, you know, just erode the trust in published research.
Like,
because normally when you see that something is published in a peer-reviewed magazine, you sort of... There's a pretty high level of credibility that that it has. But then again, on the other hand, as someone noted on social media, we are talking about a very small number of articles. So compared to the total amount of papers published every day, it's almost nothing. So it's probably not a huge issue as of right now, but definitely a pretty good thing to catch at an early stage.
Yes, and I just hope that writers know, like, speaking as an editor, I hope that writers know that we can tell. Like, if we actually read the text, we can tell. There's a specific tone to it.
Yeah, pretty often. Same goes for images. I think by now I can tell in most cases whether an image is generated.
And I'm sure this will change over time as these tools get more and more sophisticated, or we have our own personal versions that actually only sample your writing to take on your note. For example, I've seen that... One of my favorite authors, Joe Abercrombie, a fantasy writer, when ChatGPT was just launched, and he did this Twitter thread where people posted, where they had prompted ChatGPT to tell me this in the style of Joe Abercrombie. And it came out really good. Like, of course you could, I mean, there were things that made you see that, okay, this is not quite kosher. But it was actually really accurate in terms of his style. And so I think if this technology starts to become more personalized further on, then if you feed it only your what you've written before, maybe it can come up with your style as well. I don't know.
Stop giving instructions.
Yeah.
But by the way, while we're
prompt
on this topic,
engineering.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. And yeah, when I was saying that I can recognize a generated image, I think it mostly works for reasonably unsophisticated prompts. Because like you can prompt your way, I think, around pretty much any detection mechanism at this point, if you're really good at it. But while we're on this topic, by the way, I noticed that just the other day, the European Commission released a set of guidelines exactly on this, on the responsible use of generative AI in research. And I have not read them in full yet. I just saw it recently, but I will leave a link in the show notes for everyone to check it out. So at least that now exists.
So now let's move to today's featured interview with Tanguy Goretti and Adrien Roos, who are co-founders of the Belgium-born e-bike startup, Cowboy. So this week, Cowboy just launched its latest model called the Cross, which it's meant to take riders, they say, from urban environments to longer commutes and sort of weekend outdoor activities. We tried the bike.
We did.
We did on a glorious, sunny, pre-spring day in Amsterdam, which we were delighted with. And I'm pretty sure the publicists of a bike company felt very blessed with the good weather. So we did have a very nice time, I have to say. And the bike itself has an inverted front fork and seat post suspension. I found this very comfortable, specifically on the slightly less even road. And it should be good for both road bumps and cobblestones. And it also has wider tires. What it also has is a new battery. And this, I would say, has an impressive 50% greater capacity. And it can reach up to 120 kilometers in range. And it charges in only 3 hours. Hmm. It also has a whole range of cool features that you can read more about in our coverage of the launch, to which we will, of course, leave a link in the show notes.
Yeah, absolutely. I like the bike as well. I think it's really interesting. It's fully automated. So basically, there are no modes, like a sport mode, eco mode, normal mode that you would often see on electric bikes. There are no gears that you can change. So everything is basically very sleek, and there is not much tinkering to be done with.
No, and for someone who is quite of an e-bike novice, I should say, like me, that's a very positive thing. I also very much appreciated the minimalistic design of the bike itself. I know some people who might miss a boost button, but overall, I think it's a great addition to the Cowboy line.
Yeah, basically, in this case, if you want a boost, still under the limit of 25 kilometers per hour, you just need to push harder.
That is true. You have legs. But also what the Cowboy does is it senses when you're going uphill or against the wind, and then it actually adds more power.
Yeah, that's exactly what I mean. It's a sort of, it recognizes what you want in a way as well. So basically, if you try to push harder, it will actually give you more power. That's at least what I felt when I was riding it.
Yeah, good for the bridges of Amsterdam.
Oh, yeah.
Not so much hills, but no, we certainly do have bridges.
Yeah, so we did this interview with the four of us, the co-founders of Cowboy and the two of us. And here's the conversation. So just imagine us standing on a glorious pre-spring day in the sun, surrounded by the new e-bikes and talking about all sorts of things from the actual bikes to the story of Van Moof and everything in between. So enjoy the conversation and we'll be back in a minute. Okay, so can you guys first introduce yourselves and talk a little bit about your own sort of background, what you've been doing so far?
Hey, hi, good afternoon. So my name is Adrien. I'm one of the co-founders of Cowboy, also a CEO. Cowboy is my second company. Before that, I had a food delivery startup and created this company together with Tanguy in 2017.
Great. Tanguy?
Yeah, nice to meet you guys. So Tanguy Goretti, CTO of Cowboy. Before that, I also had another company called Jump. It was a ride-sharing company competing against Uber. And that's actually how we met with Adrien, because he was competing against Uber Eats. So we had a common enemy, and then we decided to launch Cowboy together.
And what's with this company now? How did it end? Or did it end? Was it acquired?
I had to, you know, like the food delivery ended up a bit of a madness during that period. You know, Uber Eats arrived with budgets of billions of euros. Deliveroo raised hundreds of millions of euros. We only raised a couple of dozens of millions of euros. So unfortunately, I had to stop that venture. But it got us into this one, And the story is that, you know, with food delivery, we had committed very early on to work exclusively with bicycle couriers. Mm-hmm. So, you know, towards the end of the journey, we were operating like thousands of deliveries, food deliveries per day in 22 cities across Europe on bicycles. And so living in Brussels, kind of started to observe the rise of e-bikes. But like I shared earlier, like what I found quite surprising was that the early adopters of that fantastic new technology were the elderly. Like first person who pitched me an e-bike was my grandfather. And so I kind of, for me, it was like a huge disconnect, but also an opportunity. Like how come the thousands of young guys, was mostly young guys, on bicycles were using like regular, not sure you call them anymore, but like regular bikes, like non-electric bikes, while my grandfather was buying this fantastic new sets of technology. And so we kind of decided to create this company to connect the dots, to accelerate the adoption of cycling. Frankly, we don't really care if it's electric or not. We just want to get people out of cars into bikes. It's healthier for themselves. It's better for the community. It's better for the planet. And thanks to the electrification of cycling, it's now easy and fun for everybody to ride a bike. And that's what we are trying to do with Cowboy.
I'm just very curious. What is your grandfather's background?
My grandfather's background was, so he was an airline pilot.
Okay. I see.
That's really interesting. So you started Cowboy in what year again?
2017. So we created the company.
Right. So it's been 7 years.
Yeah, it's exactly 7 years now.
Right. And you started with just one model that was, as you said before, a minimalistic one. But then what was the sort of product journey for you so far?
Yeah, so when we created this company, we had some experience with actually company building in the sense of, you know, raising capital, defining your vision, hiring talent, building a brand, building technology and products. But we didn't have any experience building a physical product, a hardware product.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
We also had no experience whatsoever with cycling outside of being everyday cyclists ourselves and having partnered with cyclists. And so we had to kind of learn everything about designing a bicycle. In our case, our vision was to not only build the best e-bike, but to build a connected electric bike. And we can talk more about that. We essentially, I think that's quite fundamentally different with Cowboy and every other bicycle company, is that we started by thinking of this experience as a connected experience, thinking about the future rider and what this rider will have as problems or opportunities that come along with owning a bicycle, using a bicycle on a regular basis, having to maintain it, being afraid of getting it stolen, et cetera, et cetera. And so we thought, okay, we have to build this digital connection with our riders, and we have to build it through a mobile application. And so we actually, we started working on with the mobile application. And then only when we had that vision, then we started working on the electronics within the bike that would then connect the bicycle to the mobile app and the bicycle to our platform as well, so that the bike could be updated remotely. And then we started designing the electrical system, and only then we started designing the bike. So we did all of that kind of at the same time. That was year one. We spent a lot of time in Asia, because a lot of suppliers traditionally in the bicycle industry are still based in Taiwan. More and more are now building factories here in Europe. But 7 years ago, we spent a lot of time in Asia and in Taiwan. But at the same time, we were doing everything that I was mentioning, right? Tongi was designing the app and the electronics and the electrical system, while I was designing the brand and the website and the bicycle. And then we kind of put it all together in those first 6 months, really. It took us 6 months to get to a functioning prototype.
Mm-hmm.
That's impressive.
Thank you. And then, and I think that's what impressed our first investors as well. Because, you know, at the beginning of the journey, we needed some money, not much, but we needed some money to get going, right? Because you need to start creating physical parts. It's not like just creating an app. We had to create an app, but we also had to create an electrical system and a bike. So we raised some capital, like it was less than $1 million with people that we knew. But it's only when we had this functioning, connected electric bike, which didn't look too far from what you actually still see today, 7 years down the road, that's when we impressed some venture capital. And that's when Index Venture led our first seed round. And then Tiger Global at all, Series A round, et cetera.
And what were some of the major technological challenges that you came across in the beginning? And has that changed over time?
I think the biggest challenge was to build a system. It's easy to focus on one part, like the battery, the motor, the controller, the torque sensor, or the IoT module. But the difficulty is that all those parts are made by different suppliers, and you have to make sure that they work well together. And then at the end of the day, it's all about the customer experience. So it has to make sense from a customer point of view. And what I really liked, but it was also super challenging, is how you connect the digital experience to the physical product. And so, for instance, the fact that you move the bike, use the movement sensor in the bike to detect that, and then you will turn on the bike automatically. But at the same time, you also have to use the Bluetooth signal of the phone and, again, the bike to make sure that the customer is close enough. So that kind of, you know, really complex technical challenge to basically enable a magic experience, the fact that you touch a bike, the bike turn on, and you feel that the bike is kind of connected to you and kind of feel what you want to do. For me, that was the most, the most difficult part. And it's the same thing on the assistance. We didn't want any button on the bike, any gears, any level of assistance. And so we really had to design a system that basically understands what the customers want to do. And to do that, you have to rely on all the sensors inside the bike and then take the decision on the amount of assistance you want to give to the customer. And I mean, you tried the bike today. It feels like super intuitive, super natural, and like you don't have to learn anything to ride that bike. But in the background, it was actually super complicated to do. It took us like 6 years to refine that system and actually achieve and deliver the product that we have today.
Right. And so throughout this journey, 7 years, how much money have you raised in total?
So we raised about 80 million of equity and 30 million of debt.
All right.
Slightly more than 100.
That's quite a bit. And are you looking for more then?
We're not looking for more right now. Like we're really committed to bring the company to break even and profitability. It's not really a change of direction. It's an evolution in our journey that we committed on. Well, nearly 2 years ago now, with our investors, and we well progressed on that commitment and journey. Like, in 2024, we'll be pretty close to being break even at an EBITDA level, and net profit will be next year.
Oh, right. And when you look at the market of e-bikes in general, let's take the country that you focus on right now, so in Western Europe, how close is the market to being like fully saturated?
I think it's very far from being fully saturated. From my point of view, this market is still very immature. Mm-hmm. It's quite an interesting industry, maybe like a case study, but like you have quite a lot of legacy brands. There's nothing pejorative about, you know, legacy brands, but like you have a lot of, let's say, traditional brands, right? Decent cycling brands that were created a couple of decades ago. But if you study the value creation of the parts and products and systems, I think the reality is that most of these brands missed the technology evolution in their industry. So, for example, they start with like simple systems, like the braking system or the gearing system. Most of the brands are relying on equipment manufacturers like Shimano, right? So Shimano is the leader for gearbox, for example. And then when the bikes became electric, then most bicycle makers are now relying on Bosch or again Shimano or Yamaha and others. So my point is that most of the value is being created and captured by those system manufacturers, which is pushing the price up and up and up, which is preventing those brands from having a relationship with their riders, and was also preventing the brands from designing a superior product. So that's kind of what I was trying to explain, is that we had to take the opposite approach, where we started from the rider, designing the app, designing the electronics, designing the electrical system, and then wrapping the bike around it, which enables for the customers to have a product that's beautiful, simple, and connected. But also for us, from a business point of view, it enables us to actually produce this product at a cheaper price, because we're not giving that value creation to Shimano and Bosch. We're capturing it ourselves. And thanks to the mobile application, we're also building a relationship with our community of riders, and now starting to monetize it by selling additional services like
such as
Cowboy Insurance, mm-hmm. Cowboy Care, Cowboy Connect. Cowboy Connect is now our premium version of the mobile application.
Right.
So we are starting to add those ancillary services in addition to accessories, in addition to just also purely improving the products and being there for you when you need it with repair and maintenance, which is a huge which is a very important point in this specific industry. Like,
look, I mean, you say that you're now able to not drive prices as high up as the other brands, but it's still not a cheap bike. Not by long shot. Not the Cross. Not the previous models. So how do these two things work together?
Yeah, it's a very very good question. And pricing is something that we spend more and more time as a leadership team thinking about and talking about. And it's far from straightforward. Like, and I understand your point. Like, our mission is really to accelerate the adoption of cycling. And so for us, if you want to stay true to that mission, you have to make it as affordable as possible. And you have to, in theory, bring the price as low as you can. And so the first business plan that I made 7 years ago, I actually wanted to launch this product close to €1,000, Cowboy One. That was the original idea. And then you start building the product, you start realizing that you don't want to compromise too much. You don't want to cut corners on quality or performance or innovation. And then Cowboy One, we ended up launching it at 1.8, so nearly €2,000, which by today's standard would make it a cheap bike, I think.
Reasonably priced.
So it's still not cheap, right? But I think that's the point, is that even at €2,000, it's still going to be one of the most expensive purchases that most people make within a year, right? And so our current classic and cruiser models are priced at 2.7. We did quite a lot of work to keep the base price as low as possible. Here we're launching Cross at 3.9, so close to €4,000 with an early bird price of 3.5. Simply because over the years we've learned that we cannot cut corners on quality, on performance, on innovation, and on margin. Frankly, given our goal as a business is to become break even, profitable, and I think no one wins if the company is not a sustainable company. So the question becomes, how do you make it more accessible? Well, there's a couple of different ways. One is that we're partnering with those buy now pay later platforms, so that already reduced the entry price. Another way is that a lot of people actually within in Europe, and very true here and in the Netherlands and in Germany and Belgium, a lot of people are buying those products with leasing through their employer. And so with 36 months, installments, like, and it's taken from their gross salary, the impact on their net salary is like close to 50, 60 euro per month. So I think that becomes really affordable. And I think that's a great way for governments and employers to help here making these products more affordable. And then for us, how do we reduce the price? I think it's a question of scale. You see that it took Tesla like maybe 20 years to launch the Model 3, or iPhone 20 years to launch the Model SE. I think it's unfortunately going to take us a while before we can release this kind of high quality product at what someone would call a cheap or affordable price.
Are you thinking about introducing an entry level model that's cheaper than the current lineup?
So we've been thinking about it since day one, right? And I think the reality is that we have not found this magical solution yet to significantly reduce the price. So I think
more VC money,
more VC money. Yeah, well, that's not very
not sustainable.
That's not what we want to do. But honestly, that's why the base price of our Classic and Cruiser is at 2.7, which I think is. Well, as we discussed, right, it's still a lot of money, but I think it's one of the most aggressively priced points for a premium and high quality product.
Oh, absolutely.
No, I think we've definitely seen that taking on more and more funding is not the recipe for success in the e-mobility space. No names mentioned. But speaking of that, perhaps you could also explain a little bit about the accessibility in terms of maintenance, because you do have a different set of suppliers, et cetera, and what have been your thoughts about putting this new model together?
Yeah, sure. I mean, from day one, we really try to make sure that the customer experience is perfect, even from an after sales point of view. Today, we have a network of technicians everywhere in Europe that can come to your place and fix the bike for you. So you can just book an appointment through the application. It's done in just a few taps. So super easy, super simple. And then that person will show up at your door like 1, 2, 3 days later and will fix the bike. We also partner, and we've done that quite recently in 2023 with IBD, so bike shops. We now have more than 200 partners in Europe. We're going to grow that network to 500. And again, the goal for us is to make sure that we have a bike shop you can go to close to your place, close where you live, so you can get the bike fixed pretty quickly. And you can also have advices maybe on accessories or like the setup of your bike if you need to discuss with someone face to face. On top of that, we've worked quite a lot on the diagnostic of the bike. So as you may know, the bike collects more than 25 data points every second when you ride the bike. And so we use all that data to basically try to understand when we have issues and to provide an accurate diagnostic to the customer, so you can then ship the parts directly to them or to the technicians or to the bike shop. And then we can basically repair and fix the issue. That's actually a tool that we've released internally in Q4. It's going to be now available for the bike shops, the IBD, in Q1. And then the goal is to release that tool to our customers so they actually have all the information directly in the app to resolve the issues. And then they will have like three options. Either it's going to be do it yourself, so you can fix the issue yourself. Either you call a technician and the technician comes to your place, or you go to a bike shop. And so we'll have those three options available to our customers in Q2. And yeah, the other point is that when we design the bike, we really think about maintenance and after sales. Obviously, we made mistakes in the past. Like, we've launched four generations of bikes, and each generation was also improving and fixing quality issues that we might have had in the past. But when you look at this bike, you can see that you don't have any buttons, any gears, any level of assistance. All of that is basically super useful, because if you don't have gears, then it means you don't have to maintain those components. At the same time, we use a belt on the bike, so it's clean. You don't have to wash it all the time. For the brakes, it's hydraulic brakes. Same thing, you shouldn't need to tweak them too much. The suspension, the new one on this specific bike, is also super easy to maintain, because you actually don't have to do anything. When you get the bike the first time, you just have to adjust the tension on the spring, and then you're good to go. So my point is, we really try to design the bike for zero maintenance. We know sometimes you can have issues, so that's why we have that network. But really, the goal is that you shouldn't go to a bike shop to get your bike fixed.
Right. I mean, this bike and the other Cabo bikes, they do look quite, let's say, proprietary. So there's a lot of parts that are just not off-the-shelf components. And as you just described, you use different manufacturers, different value chains. So there was another company that did a lot of proprietary parts. It was called Van Moof, and it didn't end very well. So, like, what are your learnings? I know that you followed the fall of Van Moof, and you helped out the riders of Van Moof. What are your lessons that you learned of the fate of the company, and like, what do you do not to repeat the issue, repeat the mistakes?
Yeah, so I'm gonna build on what Tanguy was saying. So, and it circles back to what I was saying as well at the beginning, is that we believe that there are tons of ways to improve the rider's experience and to build a superior product. That being said, we are not trying to reinvent the wheel when it's not needed, right? So as you can see, the bike looks beautiful, but there isn't that much innovation on the hardware side, right? On the hardware side, so the bike itself, we are really focused on designing a beautiful product, a simple product. But most of our innovation is actually centered on the technology, on the mobile application. So I think it's a fundamental difference in how we are approaching value creation, differentiation, and innovation. And actually on the bike itself, on the bike parts themselves, we're trying to keep them as simple as possible, as high quality as possible. And while we do not just content ourselves from buying and assembling off-the-shelf parts, the truth is that we work with the same with a lot of manufacturers that are the same manufacturers. We ask them to design parts with us so that they fit our design principles. But it's not like we're manufacturing anything ourselves. We are relying on the same highly capable manufacturers as the manufacturers that any kind of traditional bike brands would rely on, that you find in your local bike shops. So the quality of the engineering is pretty much on par, if not better, as what you can find in traditional bike shops. And I think our way of innovating on the bike is not to try to reinvent the wheel, on the bike itself, but to add value on the software and the connectivity.
And as you say, you highlight the innovation on the digital parts and the connectedness of the bike. What are some of the features that you're more excited about? Or I guess, of course, you're excited about all of them. But if there's anything that you wanted to highlight, and also perhaps if you look a little bit and speculate about the future, what will a rider's relationship to their bike look like, say, 10 years from now?
I mean, I'll start with what we did build, and I'll let Tanguy finish on the vision and what we're working on now. But essentially, our focus for the first few years first was to, as we said, right, we designed our own system. So it's about making the parts work together. And that was the first step. The second step was, when we had a functional product, how can we reduce friction? So we really focused on reducing frictions. And that meant mostly focusing on keeping you, the rider, and your bike safe and healthy, right? So we work on pretty advanced theft detection, theft prevention functionalities. So for example, if you don't have your login, stealing a Cowboy bike is completely worthless because no one can switch it on except if you have the login. So it has no value if it's stolen. In addition to that, we have a pretty accurate detection system because since Cowboy 1, actually, we have GSM and Bluetooth and GPS within the bike. So most of our stolen bikes actually get found back by our riders, and so it's actually starting to become known within the big cities by the community of bike thieves that they should leave the Cowboy bikes behind, and that happens more and more. Sometimes you see like a lot of bikes are being stolen, and the Cowboy bikes are still there. Those are just examples on like what we were focusing on in the beginning, and focused a lot of anti-theft, which is a big friction for users. Another one is crash detection. Like, we want to make sure that if you do have a fall, unfortunately, for whatever reason, we want to make sure that you're okay. And we have a bunch of sensors within the app, within the bike, sorry, and we also use the app. And so if we detect a crash, and our crash detection system is pretty accurate, so when we detect a crash, we ask you if you're okay. If you're not saying that you're okay within a minute, we're going to send your exact location to your person of contact, to your emergency contact, so that they can check on you and maybe even like pick you up. So those are the kind of really down-to-earth features that we were focused on at the beginning. And now that we have essentially pretty mature sets of features in those areas, we're focusing more and more on gamification now as like kind of a single player game. And the vision is to go more and more into multiplayers and make it social.
And then you're playing World of Warcraft on your bike before you know it.
Mario Kart.
With augmented reality.
Yeah, with Apple Vision Pro on your head. Perfect.
What we also did the last few years was focus on services. So we've discussed that already, but the fact that you can order a maintenance directly in the app, like we're going to double down on that. So now you also have the accessories, the setup of your bike directly available in the application. We want to make those services more accessible to our customers. And on the other side, also the diagnostic part that we've discussed, we believe that our customers should have all the tools to fix their bike. So that's going to be something that we're going to focus on. And then, like Adrian was saying, we also believe that so you spend on average 20 minutes on your bike every day. And we believe that those 20 minutes, they have to be the best time of your day. And so once you've solved all the issues, like all the bad things, or the theft, the crash detection, the safety, we also have that partnership with Google Maps to use the best navigation system in our app. Once you have all of that, you can focus a bit more on the fun thing. And so the idea is to make sure that we push you to use your bike a bit more by giving you like small changes, or to let you know about the next milestone coming for you. And we are super excited about that, because in the beta we really see that a lot of customers can actually play those games, and we love those games, and they really interact with the bike and the application even more. And what we see in the stats is that they use the bike more often, and for us that's such a huge win, because what we believe is that if they use the bike more often, it means that they will replace more car trips with it, and that's basically our mission as well. So we will continue to make the bike more fun, more engaging, and we can do that only because we have the application connected to the bike.
Makes sense. Yeah. So can I still ask about the lessons from the Van Moof bankruptcy? Is there something that you actually sort of actively thought about, some lessons that you formulated for yourself, some errors that you don't want to repeat with Cowboy?
Yeah, I think there's three points. One is one that we discussed earlier, is that we think it's very hard to create and capture value on the hardware side and to try to reinvent the wheel. And we want to keep the electric bike, the bicycle itself, as simple as possible, and innovate on the software. The second point is that it's very related. Like we know that because it's really hard, then you end up having incredibly high like failure rates, and you need to be extremely good at maintenance and repairs. And this is something that we are obsessed on as well. We had Cowboy Mobile Service since the very first day, so we're mobile technicians essentially, and we're doubling down on service by partnering with bike shops as well. And that comes I think the third point is on the financials. Is quite important to innovate, but it's key to build a sustainable business, and you need to keep both your unit economics in check. So like everybody else, I think we've had challenges during the COVID years, but we're now back to like pre-pandemic levels in terms of gross margin, like north of 40%, which is, we think, the minimum needed in this industry to make it, and keep your overall cost base in balance as well. Like while Van Moof at its peak was slightly bigger than Cowboy, they had about 10 times more employees than we did. So we are a fairly lean team of about 100 people, and we intend to keep it this way. So I think, yeah, those three points.
Right. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And a totally different question, something I read about yesterday, that there was a test in Amsterdam of a system that would allow to remotely slow down electric bikes. Basically, so there is a device being tested that could be added to an electric bike, and then it can be remotely slowed down in a certain area that, for example, is a school or like a pedestrian zone or something like that. So your bikes are limited by 0.5 kilometers per hour, right?
Yeah, they're fully legal.
Mm-hmm. And so would you, like, if you were asked to, would you consider adding this kind of device, for example, to the bike? If a city asked you, if a country asked you?
We will always follow the local and national and European legislation, right? So that's not really, I think, an opinion, something that we will have to do if it comes to that. It's not something that I would personally encourage. Personally, I think that the speed limit at 25 kilometers per hour, I mean, it's a weird limit, right? It's a limit on the assistance, not on the speed of the vehicle itself. It's already quite quite strict when you think about it, because essentially you're asking people who are on a very light vehicle to ride fairly slowly, while people who ride like a 1 to 2 tons vehicle have absolutely no speed limits on the manufacturer's side, right? So it's quite weird when you think about it. Like car manufacturers can build vehicles that have no speed limit designed in the vehicle, while for the bicycles, it's actually on the manufacturing side.
Yeah, so, but for the cars, there is traffic monitoring and there are fines, but while for the bikes, there aren't any. No, nobody's controlling the speed that you ride your bike.
But maybe we should.
Nobody's issuing fines if you ride too fast.
I would actually be in favor of having license plates on e-bikes and having every vehicles follow the same legislation.
Right. No, that makes sense. Thank you. Do you have a view on these kind of solutions?
Yeah, I mean, I will build on what Adrian was saying. Today, we have the tech in the car industry to actually limit those cars in those specific areas. And I think we should look at the numbers. I don't have the stats for the accidents on e-bikes. I mean, we do have those numbers for Cowboy, but I don't have them for the industry. But my point is, if it can help and if it can make our streets safer, let's do it. But let's not forget like the big problem and like the elephant in the room. And I think the elephant in the room is that we don't tackle the car accidents like hard enough. And again, we have the technology to limit those vehicles and we don't do it today. So I'm just saying, let's also have that discussion.
There is work being done on that, actually. I think we covered it a couple of years ago.
Yeah, but I mean, like Adrian was saying, you just react to a speed infraction while you could limit that speed in the vehicle itself. And actually, we already do it for kick scooters. So all those operators, they are limiting the speed of those kick scooters in key area. And for instance, in Brussels, it makes complete sense. So you have some area, it's like fully pedestrian, and the speed of the of those kick scooters, it's limited to 15 or to 10, I don't remember. And it makes sense. It's safer. But let's do that for kick scooter, for bikes, for e-bikes, and for cars. That's my point.
Well, thank you so much, Tanguy and Adrian. Thanks a lot for taking the time. The bike is gorgeous. I really like it. Do you like it, Linnea?
I did. It was a lot of fun, actually. And it brings back also a little bit of the joy and with the bicycle, like in the discovery that you used to have a little bit more as a kid, and not just, oh, no, the wind is in my face again, and here I have to cycle home through the rain. And but, yeah, having that little bit of extra swoosh was, it was really fun.
That's a very Amsterdamer bike rant.
And it is gorgeous, I have to say. The design is really stunning. So
thank you so much and good luck.
Thanks.
Now, big thanks to Tanguy and Adrian for finding the time to come on the show. And for us, this is all we have time for in this episode of the TNW podcast. Thank you so much for listening. If you like our show, please help us spread the word. Tell a friend or colleague about the show and follow our updates on social media. Just search for The Next Web and you will find us pretty much everywhere. Our music and sound engineering is done by SoundPulse. Feel free to email us with any questions, suggestions, and opinions. We're always at podcast@thenextweb.com. I am Andrew Degler.
And I'm Linnea Algen.
Have a great week. Talk to you next Wednesday. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.